This is a previously recorded episode.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
It's Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch.
And you're listening to M Squared TechCast, and we're kicking off something new this month, this week, where we're going to be doing a cybersecurity segment with Dan Lorman and Richard Steenen, longtime friends of ours who are the experts in the area.
They are the foremost tech security experts in Michigan, as far as I'm concerned, and that's not just because you're on our show, but it's kind of because you're on our show. But hey, we like you guys. We really think a lot of you guys, you know what you're talking about, and cybersecurity, you know, there is no bigger topic right now in the tech world. So we are glad to have you here and let our listeners know what the state of the art is.
And Richard's in studio and Dan's out there in the cosmos somewhere. We're at Lansing, I think, right?
That's right. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, great. So we're going to kind of turn the show over to you. You guys are all set up. Later in the second segment, we're going to have the Michigan Chief Information Security Officer joining us. But take it away.
Great. Thank you, Mike and Mark. So, if we have such high accolades in the cybersecurity arena in Michigan, you two are the grandfathers of tech reporting. So
I like that. Grandfathers of tech reporting.
I'd rather be the godfather of tech reporting, actually, but that's okay.
Then who's a consigliere?
Yeah, where's my Tom Hagen when I need him? You know, come on.
So, Mike, welcome thanks for your welcome to us. And Dan, I'm glad to have you co-hosting these segments with me. So today we're going to talk about state cybersecurity. So, and obviously,
yeah,
Dan, you're the guy.
It's great to be on with you. Thanks so much. And I'm really honored both to be on the program, but also to talk about this topic, which is, you know, there's a lot of reports recently that have come out on this topic. So why don't you kick it off?
Okay. And you and I have been discussing, state cybersecurity for at least 10 years, I think. I remember the first time we met, I was chairing a panel that you spoke on to talk about the Michigan State Police and all the great work you had done coordinating their coming into the what was then the 20th century, I think.
That's right.
But
exactly.
It's come such a long way that organizations like the Pell Center are writing reports. They've just published, as of November, a State of the States on Cybersecurity, written by Francesca Spildalieri, who's a senior fellow at the Pell Institute. And she put together this 42-page report where basically she was checking out the, I guess what you and I would call the maturity level of various states. And she identified 8 states that deserve to be in her report. And listing them alphabetically, they were California, Maryland, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Texas, Virginia, and Washington. And when I saw that, you know, I couldn't help but think of how, you really deserved a lot of the credit for Michigan being there. I think you drove this from the day one, didn't you?
Well, thanks. No, I mean, I've certainly been involved in Michigan, government for 17 years. I joined Security Mentor last August. But, I look at the list and, it is an impressive list, I think. We'll talk about this. I think some of the states listed, like California, did just go, have big audit findings, which, waters down the list a little bit. But I think overall it is a really good list, and it's a good methodology that the Pell Center put together. And so, talking through what those things they looked at, what some of those findings were, I think is really, really important.
Yeah, let's go over that. I've got the page in front of me where they created kind of a consumer's report on each of the states, and they lined them up with the various 5 segments that they looked at. And when you look at it, you go, wow, you know, Michigan actually came out the best, I think. It's only got a couple of the points filled in with the classic half circle. The rest are all checks and one X. But they go, you know, cybersecurity strategic plan. And I know Michigan has had that for going on 3 years now, right?
That's right. And actually, there's two different plans that Michigan has now, and I think Christian will talk about that in the next segment a little bit. But there's a 2011 version of the plan that Governor Snyder came out with in October of 11, and there's a 2015 plan they just came out with. So people can go to Michigan.gov /cybersecurity, and they can see those plans, and they can see the latest plan. But, yeah, absolutely, we've had a Michigan's had a plan for 4 years now.
And then Michigan does well on incident response, law enforcement. They've got an e-crime and data breach notification law, so they get a check mark for that, as well as information sharing and cyber R&D. And a subheading under there is higher education and workforce development, which I know Michigan has been very serious about.
Absolutely. And I think in the cyber area, the education, the capacity building, R&D, number five in the categories, we have the Michigan Cyber Range, which, you know, people can go to merit.edu /cyber range. Again, just the website you can visit, which really talks about what's going on in the Michigan Cyber Range. But a lot of great universities that are NSA certified, programs like, you know, UD Mercy, Eastern Michigan, Walsh College, others. You know, you probably have to name all the other ones, but there's a lot of really great training. I know Davenport does a great job in Michigan. So there's really a great list of universities and colleges and also community colleges in Michigan that are doing a great job in cybersecurity.
Now, let's just be a little controversial here and ask the big question is why does University of Michigan seem to back off on cybersecurity? They don't have a degree. They treat it as a very, very small subdomain of the computer science department.
That's a great question. And Michigan State as well. You know, I've worked with some of the University of Michigan and Michigan State. They have they go after grants and things within, you know, subsections, but they don't have the wider cybersecurity degrees. They don't have the same kind of, you know, certifications that a number of other universities in Michigan have become famous for. And I'm really kind of surprised about that as well. You know, Michigan State and Wayne State and University of Michigan, all three of those obviously are very, you know, prestigious, and especially University of Michigan in their areas, how they do engineering research. They certainly have people that know about cybersecurity, but they don't have degrees in those areas. So what do you think, Richard? Why is it that Michigan doesn't have that?
Yeah, when I've looked into it, and of course I'm a Michigan grad, so I'm talking about my own school here. But they, like you
go
said,
blue.
They're looking for the grants and the support.
Good luck Saturday, by the way. Okay, sorry. I don't want to derail this. I just want to put it out there. So.
And they you know, they're not going to, you know, they're a theoretical school, right? So they're looking at deep research into deep things. And they treat security as an operational issue for the most part. Now, not to say there aren't some fabulous graduates from Michigan who have really attained great heights in the worlds of cryptography and computer security. So I guess, you know, if you look at it, it's, hey, let's get a degree from one of the best schools in the world and we'll take it in any direction we want because we're so well prepared. I think that's their attitude today.
Well, what that was one of the things I wanted to ask when it comes to cybersecurity education. Is it math? What is it? What is its foundation? What are you, fundamentally studying?
What a great question. Yeah, you know, since it is a completely artificial world created by humans, right, built up from computers and networks – it is studying things that are very practical and objective, right? And there's threat actors. So a lot of cybersecurity research and writing right now actually falls into social and political science realm because of the, you know, the nation-state contribution, cyber warfare, cyber terrorism is obviously in everybody's mind in recent days. And I think that's, you know, the difficulty right now is where would you put such a department?
Hmm. Well, one question, Richard, I guess I have, you know, there's a lot of talk in Michigan about, you know, kind of Internet of Things and cars and connected cars. I mean, do you see that as an area that Michigan or Michigan State or someone else is going to be focusing on? Is, you know, kind of the future of cybersecurity in more kind of non-traditional ways?
I sure hope so. And, you know, we know there was just a conference on connected cars and security. I think it was actually in Ann Arbor just a few weeks ago. So I think Michigan's got a chance to lead in that arena.
Well, then there's their whole M-City development, too, the 30-some acre virtual city and freeway and highway interchange area they have, where they're going to essentially let autonomous or semi-autonomous cars play and, you know, just test and see how they perform. So that's obviously an area they're deeply interested in. They're spending a lot of money on that M-City development.
Yeah, if they can get Uber and Google to set up facilities here, too, that'd be great.
Yep.
Hey, Richard, one thing I wanted to ask you was, you know, as you look at government overall, and this report we're talking about is, you know, rates Michigan very highly, rates Maryland very highly, had a lot of three-letter agencies, Virginia highly, around Washington, that area. I think most people in the country know that they're known for having a lot of cybersecurity and technology companies. I mean, do you think government overall is this an accurate reflection of what you see going on right now in the industry? I mean, is government behind private sector, ahead of private sector? I mean, what are your thoughts about, you know, okay, maybe these are the top eight and we're in that list, which is great in Michigan, but I mean, what are your thoughts about where, as a whole, state government, local government, even, of course, federal government's had their problems with the OPM breach. How's government comparing to the private sector right now?
Yeah, it's been my opinion forever that government's way behind, and I think this report actually helps support that because it looks at very high-level things, and that's something we can get into is what else states can be doing. But the government is finally getting its hands around the problem and recognizing it, and, you know, every 6 months there's a wake-up call, and every organization goes through that. They just haven't been as publicly aired as government issues. And I got to sit in on a dinner with Andy Osmond from DHS just 2 weeks ago, and you could really see that not only do they get it, but they're actually trying to do something. So it's been long and slow, and they're rolling out various levels of Einstein, so network monitoring and intrusion prevention at network access points, which is, you know, you and I know that's 2002, 2003 levels of maturity. But they're getting there, slow as governments work. And evidently DHS has launched their cybersecurity sharing center as of beginning of November. And just about anybody can connect to that and start getting threat intelligence feeds directly from the Department of Homeland Security. So change is happening, and you know, it's always going to be slow and too late, and probably nothing is being done to counter, you know, the great fear that we all have that there are going to be attacks on critical infrastructure. But that's going to happen, and I think everybody agrees that there will be a time when we lose power or communication or traffic signals due to cyber attacks, and then there'll be massive reaction. Hopefully by that time, the resources, the people, the legislation is queued up so that they can do something that's effective.
Yeah. Traffic lights. It reminds me of a book I read one time. I think it was called Cyber Stiletto. Anyway, we won't go into that.
Yeah, so. We thought of that. And think how long ago we wrote that.
4 years ago, yes. Yeah,
wow.
Well, there wouldn't have been an Apollo program without Sputnik, right? There needs to be some kind of a galvanizing event, it seems like.
Yeah, and OPM has really changed the thought process inside the Beltway. I've been there a couple times in the last couple months, and that's all everybody talks about is OPM and how to react. Now, unfortunately, when I hear panels discuss it, as I did at a Chertoff group meeting, DHS and Chertoff people, all they could talk about was risk management principles being applied, you know, which is the high level. And I'm an advocate for bottoms-up security. So start doing it at the low level, start at the protocol level.
I think most of the breaches are, you know, somebody's opened a bad email or some employee that's all pissed off about something.
Andy Osmond said out of 1,000 incident responses that he's been involved in, only 4 were sophisticated. All the rest were spear phishing attacks.
Social engineering.
I mean,
right.
Georgia just had a major incident that, you know, getting a lot of press down in Georgia and in government. environment of 6 million records of drivers, and it was an inadvertent release by one of their employees who they've now announced was fired. But people can look that up and read about the Georgia Secretary of State branches, and there's a lot of this lawsuits. It's a big deal down in Georgia right now, but that's getting a lot of news at the government level.
Yeah, and Georgia's not on our list here, is it?
No, they're not.
All right.
Well, they're on somebody's list now. It might not be a good one. So
we're going to go to a short break, and then when we come back, we're going to have the Michigan Chief Information Security Officer join us.
They kind of cleaned it up and things, so we'll see how that evolves.
All right.
Great. All right. Let's go to break, and we'll be back shortly. This is Mike Brennan,
and it's Matt Rausch,
and you're listening to M Squared TechCast.
We're back with the M Squared TechCast. It's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan. And we're doing a special, it's a monthly update we're going to be doing, offering this one. Well, it's the working title is a cybersecurity update until you guys come up with something better.
Yeah, please help us rename it. We don't like it either.
So. It's like when we started out, what did we call ourselves? I forget, but it was something else. But we didn't like that name either.
Yeah.
So, we have with us Dan Lorman, who's calling in from Lansing, and we have in studio Richard Steenan, a longtime friend of mine, co-author of that famous novel Cyber Stiletto that didn't sell worth a damn, but hey, what the heck, you know? And we have also on the phone Christian. Go ahead, give it to me.
I know.
Thank you. God, I was dying there. Yes.
And he is chief information security officer for the state of Michigan. So welcome.
And thank you for having me.
All right, we're going to turn it over to Dan and Richard to run with the ball here.
Hey, Christian, it's great to have you on, thank you for your service to the state. And just mention to the listeners about your background, you know, with Chemical Bank, and then your adjunct professor of information assurance at Davenport University, and also certainly your experience and all you've done, Consumers Energy, and now being CSO for the state of Michigan, you've been in your role for about 100 days, or give about maybe a little bit more than that. You joined back in August. So how are things going, and what are your biggest surprises and you know, kind of the good, bad, and ugly of your first 100 days?
Sure. Thanks, Dan. I think the funny thing is I had a lot of misconceptions coming to the state because, you know, I've always been in the private sector, and you just kind of hear how bad things are in government. And really, you know, it's the same issues you have no matter where you're at. You know, you either have some bad people, you have a bad process, or you have some bad technology. And the state's been great. I have a really great, and you know as well, dedicated team of security professionals that are just very happy to be at their jobs and really love what they're doing. And I think that's one of the things that I look for in people is really the passion. You know, you can train them in technology, but if they don't have a passion, you know, they're really not going to be the best employees that you can get them to be. But the state's been great. Right now, just working on I finished drinking through the fire hose, and it already feels like I've been there a year. So just looking at the organization as a whole, kind of getting to know the people, and getting my feet started on a lot of the projects that were started before I got there.
Fantastic. That's great. Well, you know, I guess there's one follow-up, and I'll hand it over to Richard. But I just, you know, what other, is there one thing that's been kind of the biggest surprise or one hot project you can tell us about that you're working on with the state right now?
I guess as far as the surprises, and maybe it wasn't such a surprise as maybe one of the misconceptions that was kind of true, I guess, is that things do take a little bit longer to make happen in government. So I found that out fairly shortly in my career there. But really just knowing the culture and the politics, knowing how to navigate them has helped me out a lot. As far as projects, I think the main thing that we're looking at is really just anything that has to do with detection and response, you know, refining our incident response process, making sure all of our process and procedures, one, they exist and they're documented to make sure that if we do have people leaving that, you know, we don't have a huge gap in controls from people leaving. But two of the main things we're working on right now would be the NIST Cybersecurity Framework Initiative, where we're going through and basically using that as a template to map all of our policies, procedures, and controls to that government document, as well as looking to enhance our data loss prevention capabilities, looking at some host-based software to make sure that when information does leave, we're aware of it, and we also know what type of information is leaving so we can put proper controls around that.
Christian, this is Richard. That's great to hear. Were you involved or did you get the heads up that the State of the States on Cybersecurity report was coming out of the Pell Center?
No, actually, I found out this morning. We've got an email saying, hey, guys, congratulations. And we're like, oh, that's awesome to hear. But, I mean, it's something that I've heard. You know, I've been a lifelong Michigander, so as far as I knew about cybersecurity, I mean, Michigan's always really been considered a leader, and, you know, obviously in many thanks to Dan on that front for putting this up there. But it's just great to know. Like I said, I was recently at the MSISAC conference in San Diego, and that's the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center, and that's basically a conglomerate of states that kind of share threat intel, and the MSISAC also can provide security services for states at a cheaper rate than most third parties. But it was really good just meeting the other CSOs and CISOs and just realizing that, you know what, we all have the exact same issues. You know, a lot of it's either budget or resources, but we're all defending ourselves against the same threat actors. So making those relationships has really been just a big positive win in my book.
Yeah, and the best way to get that information sharing started is to actually meet the people that you're talking to.
Exactly. Meeting the people really forms a trust. And I've been part of my career earlier was in financial, so I was part of the FSISAC, and then in the electric sector I was part of the EISAC. And again, getting the information from those actual organizations is great, but the things that really helped us out the most were actually the relationships that we created and that we had, you know, these energy companies or these financial institutions that if I saw something weird, I could say, hey, guys, this is what I'm seeing. Are you guys seeing this? And they would do the same thing. So there was really just a really quick turnaround, and we're able to kind of get the alert out very fast and help prevent other people from being compromised.
So DHS is finally starting their information sharing program. Have they reached out to the MSISAC to, you know, tell them how to get connected to it?
In parts, they have. When you talk about threat intelligence sharing and the government, there's a lot of, I guess, balls up in the air right now with different legislature out there, because right now certain people are afraid to share that information with the government because it could be possibly used in a FOIA request, and it could be, some people feel like, mostly private companies feel like that information could be used against them by competitors. So in my experience, it's been, and I know there's been a lot of talk about the government-led information sharing and new initiatives popping up. And it's been my experience that people have been using information sharing for, you know, years and years with the ISACs. And I think where the problem comes along is a lot of times people feel that, you know, within the community, you know, they're sharing the threat intel, but they're not necessarily getting information back from the government when they do share. And I think there's a really big ask of people that they think the government is just sitting on troves and troves of threat intel that they're not sharing. And I believe that they are sharing what they can share. For the most part, and unfortunately what it is people don't always want to share. You know, they want to get the information, but they're not willing to share. And when you have that type of mentality, you know, the community as a whole just really suffers.
Let's talk about one of the big areas that that states seem to be in competition for, and that's jobs. So we hear a lot of cyber training initiatives, and obviously the state of Maryland is kind of leading the way because of their proximity to D.C. and getting a lot of good work out of NSA and the rest of the intelligence communities that are situated in their backyard. You know, are jobs that important an issue to somebody in your role?
Definitely. It's kind of funny. I was at the NSISAC. I was talking to someone from Maui, and they were saying the issues they're having of getting people there. And I'm like, wow. I go, that's really rough when we can't get people to move to Hawaii for a cybersecurity job.
Give them
a
resume. Kind of ready.
It put everything into perspective. And I talked to a few people from Illinois, and they had the same problem where because of the high cost of living, you know, they can't afford to get the talent. And one thing we've been able to do is really get a lot of interns wrapped up in our cybersecurity program and, you know, get them on board. And I think that's really the way to go is, you know, a lot of times, you know, you may only get them for a couple years, but I take a couple years out of over no years, and it's just a great way to kind of help the young people learn about cybersecurity.
So, Christian, I guess the question I have for you is, you know, I make a comment, and then there's a question here, too. Cause in my years in working in government, and I looked at, you know, the meetings like the MSISAC meeting in San Diego you just came from, and you look across the country, and you kind of had I'd call it a third. A third of the states got it. They had active programs. We just talked about the Pell Center report, the 8 top states, and Michigan's on that list. You have a third of the states that are kind of, you know, doing well in some areas, not well in other areas, and a third of the states that are really struggling, kind of deer in the headlight. When you talk about things like dollars and action, authority, you know, really doing the things that this report lays out, what were the big hot issues that you saw that, you know, all the states are struggling with? Are there hot issues that, as a voice, you know, the state CSOs really kind of rose to the top of the agenda when you were out in San Diego that you can share with us? You know, what were the top one or two concerns or challenges that you saw?
A lot of them, it did come down to staffing and resources, but I'll put staffing at the top of that list. Just, you know, hearing everyone's concerns about not being able to get the talent there. And again, it came down to money, which to me, and I don't want this to sound too negative, but it's almost a cop-out. I mean, there's definitely people out there that need jobs, that want jobs. And I think what you have to do is kind of think, okay, I can't offer them money. What can I offer them to kind of enhance and entice them? Because, you know, working in the state, you know, you do get to work with some really cool things, you know. One, it's also the environment. You know, you're a target. So, I mean, to me, that's what I try to tell people when I'm out there recruiting is, you know, you're never going to get this opportunity anywhere else. I think the second thing really comes down to a lot of the states having issues getting cybersecurity as a really prominent role and people caring about it. And obviously with Michigan, you know, we don't have that problem. Governor Snyder, he's been amazing. I mean, cybersecurity has been a top priority for him, you know, since he came to office. And, you know, most of my career in the private sector, I spent my times dealing with board of directors and CEOs and trying to, you know, fight the fight to get them to understand that cybersecurity should be a priority. And here, I mean, it's been great because, you know, CIO David Bean, Governor Snyder, they get it. You know, I don't have to spend waste my time basically struggling to get them to get it. They already have the big picture, and they basically said, hey, go ahead. This is our priority. Make it happen.
That's great.
I've seen the same thing. It's just interesting. especially in some of the lower levels of governments, local governments, having a struggle to get them to really see it as a priority, which is pretty amazing. But, hey, Richard, back to you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Chris, for joining us. We've got to wrap up this segment, and it sounds like Dan's managed to turn the reins over to somebody who's got the state's security in good hands.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, it's time for our next break. This is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And this is the M Squared TechCast. We will be back momentarily with the new 1 gig internet service for $70 a month, now available in downtown Detroit, soon to be midtown.
Everywhere in the world.
Soon to be universe.
Soon, right?
That's right. Okay. From Rocket Fiber.
Rocket Fiber. Okay, we'll be back. It's Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch, and this is the M Squared TechCast. And we are joined now by, is it Randy Foster? Randy Foster, right. He is the Chief Technology Officer of Rocket Fiber in Detroit.
Nope. CIO, Chief Information Officer. Too many C's, you know?
Okay, he's the boss. He's one of the bosses, anyway, of Rocket Fiber in downtown Detroit. They have begun offering super fast gigabit internet in downtown Detroit for $70 a month. Now, put this in perspective here. Let's say I have Comcast, or I have another provider at home that rhymes with Bombast. We'll put it that way.
Yeah,
and
right.
And so I'm getting maybe 30 meg out of my broadband connection downtown. How long is it going to take me to download an HD movie on that, and how long is it going to take on your service?
Depending on the particular speed or the particular size of the movie, if it's HD. So it'll take about 4 seconds on our network to download an hour and 20-minute DVD.
Okay.
Your speeds are about 25 times slower than that, so you can do the math.
Yeah, okay,
no,
so an hour and a half.
No, he can't actually, because he's a writer. Yeah. Writers can't do math.
I was going to say, reporters and math, not so much, right, okay. So tell me how you guys got the idea to do this, to bring this kind of – I mean, Detroit was in the running for the Google Fiber experiment for a while, didn't get it. So how did you guys get the idea to do this sort of yourselves privately?
Yeah, so actually one of the other co-founders, Mark Hudson, he helped Lansing do their bid when he was at Michigan State for Google Fiber to come. So he had it in the back of his mind. Flash forward a couple of years, and we were all sitting around the office, and one day he's looking down Woodward and, Dan Gilbert and everything going on down to Detroit, decided that, why doesn't Google come here? Why didn't it happen? Is it now the time to do it? Within Quicken Loans, there's this idea portal. They call it the Cheese Factory, where you can submit ideas of any magnitude, right? So they threw this idea on the portal and thought that, the powers that be call up Google, and next thing you know, they show up. What ended up happening was a multi-year odyssey where we basically decided that if we wanted to do this, we need to do it ourselves. Given where Detroit was, nobody really wanted to make that investment without understanding where it is and where it's actually going.
So both Sergey and Larry showed up then, right? So, no.
Yeah. Give us a call.
All right. So you pitched this. The idea came up in 2013, the way I understand it, and you pitched it to Dan Gilbert in 2014. What happened there?
So they brought us in front of everybody, essentially. There's probably 30, 40 people in the meeting. And we laid out the business plan, laid out the strategy, laid out what it means, the sort of 1+1=3 strategy, which is it enhances everything you're doing down here. Detroit's got a resurgence. You want to drive tech, you need this. You want to create this ecosystem of gigabit products. And, you know, he kind of says, I buy into it. Let's go do it.
That's good when a billionaire says that. That's like, that's a good thing, right?
And he shakes his couch and out comes what, $30 million or plus or minus, right? Something like that.
Slightly more complicated than that, but
well,
yeah.
I know.
So how big is the footprint now and where is the footprint headed? I mean, obviously I live in Ann Arbor. This isn't going to happen out there, but I mean, how far out are you reaching?
It can happen anywhere, right? So right now, downtown and midtown Detroit is our focus. It's about 3.5 square miles total. We've put about 13 miles of fiber in that area to mostly backbone fiber, and we're building out lateral distribution right now. So I would say that our target is the downtown and midtown, but really we're looking at the 7.2 square miles of greater downtown Detroit as an important market, and we definitely want to and are evaluating where we go next.
All right. So one of the questions I asked Richard 20 years ago, probably, and I Baker and the rest of the internet pioneers around here, is where do you connect to the network? And I mean, who owns this thing? Is it like an electric utility, or you know, where are your internet actual connections to the internet that you can get speeds like this?
You know, it's funny. Everybody asks this question: how do you connect to the internet? Right? What is so the internet is a series of smaller networks connected to bigger networks. The next biggest node for us to connect with is in Chicago. So we buy transport services out to Chicago and connect with the tier one providers up there.
So people like AT&T and what are the others?
Cogent, Hurricane, Level 3.
Level 3 I'd heard of. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Neat.
This is a far cry from when I put the very first point of presence for an ISP in Detroit. It was at the Detroit Legal News. Basically put a router down there, leased a 256K line back to our pop in West Bloomfield. And then I had a stack of 56K modems down there that we maintained.
Oh, by the way, that's Richard Steenan, author of There Will Be Cyber War. So we have to throw that in there because I know people have just joined us. So I'm going to identify you there.
All right. So tell me, what is the service area again? Roughly what's it bounded by, the roads that, you know, so people know?
And so the Central Business District is bounded by the river to the south and then the, what is that, 75 to the east and 94.
Or to the north.
It's Lodge or whatever.
Yeah, then 96, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, gotcha. And so you're branching into Midtown now, which is north of there. That's essentially the medical center in Wayne State area, right?
Yep. We're starting on the eastern half of Midtown, and we'll be building back down on the western half. Actually, flip that. I'm sorry. We're starting on the western half and building back down on the eastern half starting early next year.
And when do you think that much will be done?
Done's never done, right? We'll always be building. The main backbone will probably be done early in the year, maybe February, March. But the lateral build, so all the buildings to bring them on net, it's going to be taking probably multi-years over time. It takes a lot longer to build those.
So is the plan to see just how that goes for a while, or do you plan expansion outside that area next?
I mean, we definitely would love to see where what neighborhoods and what places make sense. I think we're always evaluating options and opportunities. And similarly, it took us almost 2 years to develop the business plan just for downtown and midtown. We're currently developing plans and trying to figure out how and where we would expand from there.
And one of the neat things about this to me is that we really kind of have no idea what this is going to produce, right? I mean, when really widespread cable broadband came in, we had no idea that there was going to be a Netflix. Stuff just happens when people have access to these kinds of speeds, right? That to me, that's the most exciting part.
And that's definitely for me too. We always talk about, like I said, wanting to build an ecosystem. These type of speeds have been available to businesses for a long time, maybe not at a competitive cost point for entrepreneurs, but they've not really been readily available for residential services. So when you create an entry point for entrepreneurs to develop with these type of speeds, and then you have an actual market where you can test and deploy this product, we're very interested to see what happens. I mean, I don't think anybody knew what was going to happen with the flip from dial-up to broadband and always-on network connectivity. And it's just been great to see everything that's come out of that. And, you know, I remember back how many years did we talk about that things weren't going to happen with TV? You're going to be able to pause it. It was, you know, I feel like we heard the statements probably 10 years before it ever actually happened.
Yeah.
With internet speeds, it kind of flipped that. They just – nobody was talking about what would happen when it did. They just gave you the speed and all of a sudden stuff developed.
What has surprised you, or what has happened that you didn't anticipate that may be pleasant or even not so pleasant? But what's the issues you're dealing with or the upside?
I mean, I think the issues are there's quite a few of them. You know, when you talk about just logistics, we're deploying 13 miles of fiber at the same time you're standing up a brand new business, at the same time you're moving an office. You have to build out your own internal network structure. You have to do all your processes and procedures, which the previous guest was talking about. We struggle with the same things. We need to be able to be scalable and deploy a network and develop all kinds of things and do them in a way that's not traditionally done and be able to provide that high quality experience for our clients that we've been talking about. So combining all those things and doing the logistics, that's probably been the most complicated.
And how do you do it so cheaply? I mean, that unnamed broadband carrier, I'm in Ann Arbor spending about $70 a month and I'm not getting gig service, I'll tell you that.
I think it's a combination of two things. One is new infrastructure, right? So we're putting brand new stuff down there. We don't have to deal with legacy investment. And on top of that, we've been hyper-focused in a particular market. So we don't have to support infrastructure all across the country and pay for this legacy infrastructure and deal with all that and the scale for that. We can focus our efforts in a very small market and make it the most cost-effective deployment of capital.
Hmm.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm paying $45 or $50 a month for the aforementioned, 30 meg in Dearborn. So that's, this would be a huge step. Are you hiring at this point, or what kind of skill sets are you looking for? I know you've created about 30 jobs downtown, right, so far?
Yeah, I think we went through an initial bubble. We went from 3 to 30 in almost a year, and that's probably still somewhat light, but we need to hit the point now where we need to start bringing customers on and scaling. So we probably slowed down and built our initial team until we kind of, like I said, start bringing our customers and start seeing how everything plays out and what type of capacity we need to be able to deal with client support and installations.
And the money thing, are you going for another round of financing? Do you have a sufficient amount of money for what you're doing? What's happening with that?
We're good for what our initial goals were. If we want to try to expand, it's definitely some time to bring in somebody else or some other money to be able to help do that. It was outside the scope of what we were trying to do. If we're wildly successful, maybe we don't have to bring in money. We can just do it out of the business itself.
Yeah, and I imagine that Dan Gilbert's buildings are wired down there. Was that one of the first things you did, or
a little bit of both?
Well, he's putting up the dough, right? He wants some buildings wired.
Yeah, that's true. But he also got to bring in from money that's not for him taking out of one pocket and putting in the other. He wants to bring in some outside money too.
Internet connectivity is the most important thing, regardless of what building you are. So definitely, it was a priority to go where the density is, and Dan Gilbert buildings tend to have a lot of density. So it made sense for us, and made sense for him.
What's your sort of five-year, where do you want to be? Metro Detroit is all covered with this, and we're out into the suburbs, or what do you want to do?
You know, 5 years is not a lot of time in this business. It takes so long to grow and scale. I think that, in the next 2 years, we'll really see what happens in downtown and midtown, and I think trying to figure out how to expand from there. We definitely said that this is downtown and midtown is our core, and the city of Detroit has definitely been good to us, and it's important that we address with all the neighborhoods. But the Metro Detroit area seems like a natural fit, as well as there's plenty of other cities in Michigan that are underserved right now that we'd love to be part of.
We've got just a couple minutes before we have to go. We've talked about residential service mostly. Talk about the business plans you've got as well.
Yeah, so we offer all types of different products to businesses. We can provide Metro E services. We can provide speeds from 1 to 100 gig. Our equipment's capable of it. We don't have any particular customers online or that are intending to be online yet for the 100 gig. Definitely some competitive advantages for the city of Detroit that we'd like to at least talk about. Cleveland created a 100 gig corridor for their research hospitals. That something like that is a definite competitive advantage, especially given all the research hospitals that we got around around Detroit. Definitely like to sort of try to explore those as a growth opportunity.
Would you like to work with Merit?
We've had a number of conversations with Merit from almost the beginning. M1 Rail was a big piece in working with Merit and actually all the parties to try to dig once in that opportunity. So there's, you know, Merit's definitely a big research area. So working with them has been, like I said, from the beginning, something we've done.
Great.
Okay. Well, if people want more information about Rocket Fiber, where do they go?
www.rocketfiber.com. Check out our 10 gig service for residents.
Okay. And eventually you'll be hiring again. There will be job opportunities there as well. I always like to mention that because there is one of the things my employer, the Engineering Society of Detroit, where's the ding?
Okay. It's in front of you there.
Okay. All right.
There we go.
That's we have to ding whenever we give a shameless plug. One of the things we do is we try to fill up the pipeline because we know there's an engineering and tech worker shortage right now. So, you know, you're the folks who are the users of tech workers. So you'll be hiring soon, I'm betting.
Yeah, we're always looking for great talent, always.
Well, that's a good point. Is recruiting to Detroit easier now than it once was?
It's easier because we're not the incumbent.
Ah.
That other guy. The other guy is Brand X, as they used to call him in the commercial.
They're a sponsor of mine. I have to be nice here. So, okay. Wonderful organization.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But, yeah, it's definitely been easier with everything going on in Detroit to get talent down here than I think it probably was maybe 5 years ago.
All right. Okay, once again, thank you so much, Randy Foster from Rocket Fiber in Detroit. Check them out if you live downtown or in Midtown. They can give you internet so fast it'll make your head spin and probably your computer too, and you can download a movie in, you know, four milliseconds or something like that. Yeah, it's just ridiculous. The speeds like that are unheard of even a few short years ago.
Okay.
So, and when I hear a guy this age talk about, boy, I remember back when, it just cracks me up. So anyway.
Well, stand by. The last segment we're going to be talking about how to build a mobile app for non-techies, and I know Richard's ears perked up over there, so he's going to want to ask some questions.
Yes, there's an app development boot camp coming up in December at Automation Alley. We'll be talking about it.
December 3rd. Yeah, we'll talk about that in the next segment. Maybe Randy will want to stick with us and talk about that too. This is Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch.
And you're on M Squared TechCast.
It's the M Squared TechCast, and this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're talking mobile apps. We're talking app development. We're talking app development boot camp for non-technology people.
On December 3rd at Automation Alley, and the sponsors include Logic Solutions, the Mobile Technology Association of Michigan, and we have representatives from both of those places. Al Carpinelli is in studio with us. He's the business development manager for Logic Solutions. And on the phone is a multi-appearing personality.
Grammy Platinum winner.
Grammy Platinum winner.
Recording artist.
Linda Deschant, who runs the Mobile Technology Association of Michigan. She's been with us before, and I'm sure she'll join us again in future segments. Welcome, Linda.
I'm happy to be here.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about this, Al. Why don't you tell – this is actually for folks like – well, we write about technology, but I don't know if I'd call myself a technologist. Richard, would you call yourself a technologist?
Oh, I definitely am.
Okay, good.
All right, well, I couldn't code to save my life.
Yeah,
so
that's the problem.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay, all right.
So you're going to teach us to code? Is that what's going to happen,
Al? No, not that deeply technical. Again, it's non-techies are the audience, so – just to back up a part of the reel to give credit to the Small Business Development Centers of Michigan, Keith Brophy, in conversations with Linda Dachant from Mobile Technology Association, actually came to the concept after a discussion he had with us at Logic Solutions a few months ago. We had already been developing the workshop for the non-techies to learn how to present their idea for mobile app development. And just over conversation with Linda and Keith, Keith lit up and said, you know, that format would be so beneficial to the businesses that are active members of the Small Business Development Centers. And there are 17 centers around the state of Michigan, Upper and Lower Peninsula. And so Keith said, let's take that and let's get it on the road and take it to as many as the centers as we can in the next year. And so we're starting out with this first event in Troy, which is a great location at Automation Alley using their atrium. But again, Michael, not geared for programming people. This is really geared for business owners who have been mulling on an idea for a mobile app but really aren't sure how to get out of the gate. And they don't want to be taken advantage of. They want to come to the table to work with a mobile developer with a level of knowledge where they can define their idea and lay it out. And if they need to get competitive pricing, they'll be positioned to do that. They'll learn how to lay out their idea and solicit input from builders.
So they'll learn maybe about as much as a project manager might know. They won't actually know how to code, but they'll know how the pieces fit together and, you know, roughly what they're asking of someone to do for them.
That's a good way to put it, Matt. It is, you know, the non-programmer approach, getting your idea more from off a napkin and getting it on some paper, and particularly so defining what we'll call the value proposition. Who are you trying to help? Who's your audience? Particularly so if you're building an app that's not for private use. If you think you're taking something to market and you intend to make money, you better have a great idea for how you're going to get it to market, who you're going to compete with in that market, and be able to get revenue from that plan.
Well, one of the ideas I have for a mobile app, for instance, is there's a service out there called Smart News, where it essentially picks up feeds from lots of different publishing groups and whatnot. I would like to be able to do that with our own little group that we have, because we're up to 9 content partners, and so that you can pick and choose on stories and have it delivered to your app. Now, I've talked to folks about how much that would cost, and I've gotten wildly absurd numbers, like $40,000. So this is probably an event I should attend, right?
Love to have you, Michael.
You definitely should be there.
So, probably that's a little, somebody's blowing smoke somewhere if it's 40,000, right? I won't say where because, well, I know no FCC here, but still, we can't, right?
So, yeah, we try to maintain at least a Canadian radio level of decorum here. Yes, okay. All right. Linda, I wanted to ask you, what's the Mobile Technology Association of Michigan? What's your interest in promoting an event like this?
Well, you know, we get inquiries all the time from small business owners in particular, but even some larger companies who are not in the tech field, but they want to be able to use the technology to either provide an additional service for their customers or to manage some sort of an internal process and to help make their company more productive. And they just really don't know where to start because obviously developing a mobile app takes a lot of technical skill, and this is obviously not something they specialize in. So we get a lot of those calls saying, can you refer us to somebody who can help us? How do you get started doing this? And so when Logic Solutions came up with the original idea, and I thought, okay, what can we do with this? My immediate thought was we need to take this to the SBDC because they work very specifically with entrepreneurs and people who these days are very much interested in utilizing mobile in their businesses and don't know where to start. And that's kind of how it all came about. And for us, it's a really important thing to do as a service from our trade association to help more people engage with mobile and wireless technologies. So it's just one of many things that we do to try to get more companies involved in using these technologies.
All right. And let's get some details on the event here. Time, location, website, all that good stuff.
Sure. It is going to take place on Thursday, December 3rd, 7:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. approximately at Automation Alley in Troy. There is a $50 registration fee, and that includes all materials, continental breakfast, and a snack during the event. Anybody who is going to attend, though, needs to bring their own laptop. And we are limiting registration to 40. So if you're going to be interested in attending, you better register quick because we're getting close to that number. And they can register at www.messageblocks.com, how to build a successful mobile app bootcamp.
So, Al, what are the challenges that mobile app developers have in working with entrepreneurs like me who don't have a lot of tech coding background? I mean, how do you work with guys like me? Just beat me about the head and body or what?
It can take a lot of interview time, Michael. You know, when entrepreneurs come forward or just business owners that are well-established brick and mortar come forward and want to build a mobile app, they often struggle with defining it. Even on paper, some of the most sophisticated larger corporations will have an IT department that will at least write what we'll call their requirement specification. But the mid-sized or smaller companies don't have the staff to do that. And so they need some guidance on how do I define on paper what my app should do, you know, who it's going to benefit. And one of those questions would be, in your app, for example, Michael, you already mentioned something about soliciting information from other sources. That tells you right away you're not going to have just a mobile app in your hand. You're going to have an app that's talking to a web cloud app. And so that now raises up the level of sophistication requirement. And so when people say, well, how much my app costs, they're thinking hundreds or a few thousand. Not the case. When you're going to build a mobile app on multiple platforms, both Apple and Android, and have a web server behind it in the cloud, you're talking some fairly substantial dollars. And
like so, what, Al? Go ahead, tell us.
Well, you're north of 10K right away, Michael, and maybe heading for 30. So I don't know until we get further into your requirement
okay,
to know
yes.
what's there. So.
Well, but see, that's a good example, though, of the kind of shock that a lot of business owners have when they start talking about an app, because they have this assumption in their head that whatever it is, it must be easy for someone to do as long as they've got tech skills. So it probably wouldn't cost very much money to get it done. And so that's part of the education we want to provide. We want people to understand what actually goes into building these apps so they can have a realistic expectation so that they can put this as part of their business plan and, you know, make decisions accordingly on when they can afford to do it, what they need to get done in order to be able to do it, so that they can maximize those dollars that they're spending and get as much out of them as they possibly can.
Oh, go ahead, Matt. Oh,
yes, we are joined on the line, I believe, now by Keith Brophy. Are we not?
Are you there, Keith?
Yes, hello, this is Keith.
Hey, okay. Keith, how are you?
Keith, tell us just a little bit about tell us just a little bit, if you would please, about the small business development centers in Michigan and sort of how they're tied into this event coming up December 3rd.
Sure. The Small Business Development Center of Michigan consists of a team of about 80 consultants all across the state, and the SBDC is supported by a mix of federal, state, and university regional host funding to work with small businesses and help propel them to further success, whether startup businesses or established small businesses. We provide general counsel in areas like finance, marketing, and strategy.
And this is part of the marketing effort, right?
Yes, and this is part of also the empowering effort, as we help small businesses turn those ideas into mobile applications. And we hope that, at least in many cases, it might drive them to revenue or expanded customer base.
Is there a big demand right now by business for mobile apps? Is this something that they're all coming to you saying, gosh, I really need this?
It's something that comes up often, and it doesn't necessarily apply to every small business across our state, but it applies to many. And often it manifests itself as a small business with an idea, and they try to evaluate if only they had an application targeted to their business, you know, what they could achieve, but also what it would take for them to get there. And small businesses that don't have experience in working with vendors to create mobile apps often have no idea of the cost, the risk, but also sometimes the path to turning that idea into a mobile app is much smoother than they might envision as well. So I would say it's been a steadily increasing need that we've seen for some time.
All right, Linda and Keith, let's hear one last time about this event. We're about done with our segment here and with our show for this week, believe it or not. It's gone by in a hurry, as it always does. So it's December 3rd, right?
Yeah, December 3rd, 7:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., Automation Alley.
And that's in Troy.
The easiest way to get the information is just email me at linda@gomobilemichigan.org, and I'll send you a link.
All right. Well, it's Mike, it's been another blindingly fast hour.
Oh,
just
gosh.
Flew by.
I know. It just whips by. We want to thank our in-studio guests. We have old friend Richard Steenan. We're going to be working on that sequel to Cyber Stiletto next. I know everyone's out there waiting for that. And then we also have with us Al Carpinelli, Business Development Manager at Logic Solutions, who's involved with all these folks on the phone with the boot camp here next week already, I guess, right? Next week's Thursday.
Yep. And on the phone, we had Keith Brophy from the Small Business Development Centers of Michigan, Linda Deschent. Linda, do I pronounce that right? I know how to spell it. I just don't know how to pronounce it. Okay, all right.
Yes, you are actually saying it correctly.
I'm getting the thumbs up here from our in-studio friends. With the Mobile Technology Association of Michigan, a longtime advocate for mobile technology development in Michigan and sort of making Michigan a hub of that. Folks, you can listen to us every single Monday at 3 o'clock here at PodcastDetroit.com. And if you want to listen at your leisure, you can get recordings of these here programs by Wednesdays or thereabouts at SoundCloud.com or once again at PodcastDetroit.com.
I think at iTunes too, doesn't it?
Yeah, think so. But I'm an Android person.
We have to thank our engineer, without whom we could not produce this show.
Engineer par excellence.
The lovely Jessica. Oh,
indeed.
Yes.
Thank you, Jessica, once again.
All right. So I guess our hour is fun is over, and if I can talk here, I didn't even have a beer. If I have a beer, I can talk better, right?
Well, we can keep talking, but nobody will be listening in a minute. So.
Okay, well, this is Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch.
And this is M Squared TechCast.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at PodcastDetroit.com.
This is a previously recorded episode.